Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Crisis nurseries are facilities that provide emergency shelter care to children whose parents or guardians are not able to care for them due to a crisis. Providence House in Cleveland is Ohio's first and one of the nation's longest operating crisis nurseries. Since opening in 1981, they have cared for more than 15,000 children and families in crisis. And joining us now is CEO and president for the Providence House, Natalie Leek. She's been in her role since 2001. Welcome to All Sides, Natalie.
Thank you for having me.
Did I correctly define a crisis nursery? Can you tell me more about it and or change my definition if I didn't get it right?
Certainly. And, you know, Ohio's crisis nurseries are very unique in that we have some of the most progressive licensing allowed. We do not take custody of children in a crisis nursery. That is the biggest differentiator. So these are places that families can seek care for their children for up to 90 days in Ohio. While the children stay with us and are cared for 24/7, we are providing that intensive family support for strengthening parenting skills and connecting families to resources to resolve those crises that they're facing. Ultimately, to preserve that family, to keep them together. 99% of our children safely return home to their families. And that's been our run rate for 16 consecutive years. That intervention is so critical, and we become that family, that friend, that trusted caregiver for children so that families can focus on resolving issues like domestic violence and homelessness and mental health issues and even, you know, drug addiction. Our goal is to help those parents heal themselves so that their family can remain together and thrive.
Now, would it surprise you to know that prior to reading up on your place and doing this segment for the show, I had never heard of a crisis nursery? I mean, I've heard of going into foster care. I've heard of emergency services and that kind of thing. But is the term crisis nursery maybe not well known?
I think it's not well known and it's somewhat misunderstood. For example, in Ohio, you hear nursery. We definitely do care for newborn infants, sometimes 2-3 days old, right from the hospital. But we go all the way up through the age of 12. So we are a preteen service. Most of our school agers, though, are the older sibling of a younger sib group. So we typically see entire sibling sets of, you know, 3 or 4 children from the same family staying with us. While we help that parent or guardian work to resolve the crisis situation. There are about 60 or 70 nurseries that operate in the U.S. and Canada. As I said, Ohio, though, has really embraced this model legislatively and provided some of the most optimal conditions and licensing. So the longer length of stay, the ability to do family intervention and preservation work. So Providence House actually consults nurseries that are operating across North America to embrace the focus of family preservation, not just emergency shelter for kids, but how do we heal that whole family so that children can remain with their families and we can reduce the number of kids coming into foster care. We've got a huge aging out crisis in foster care in Ohio and nationally. My case is let's not age them in. Let's try to keep these families together.
So what is the process for getting help from your organization? Is there an application? Does someone just call you up? Because if it's a crisis, then it's also an emergency, not planned, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing about crisis nursery referrals is 87% of our clients self-refer. So these are, you know, moms, dads, grandparents who are calling us and saying, I heard about you from somebody else who used your service, or in my church, or in my community. And so that speaks volumes to the trust that families have with this program. We do receive referrals from the local Child Protective Service Agency. A lot of times those are hotline calls where it's really not escalating, and they're saying, hey, call the crisis nursery, see if they can admit your children. And this is, another interesting kind of fact is about 65% of the families we serve, the parent or guardian themselves was foster care involved. And they're saying, this is not, I need help now before it gets to that level. So these are families that are really seeking support in a very preventative way, knowing they need care for their children to really tackle the crisis that they're facing.
And you mentioned a moment ago that an average of 99% of families who brought a child to stay in your crisis nursery are reunited after using your services. I mean, 99%, that's a pretty good percentage. How do you accomplish that?
I think it's again that voluntary choice. So nobody forces the families to bring their children here. They are coming here with their most precious treasures and saying, I need you to keep my children safe and help me get my life back on track, rebuild my family. And we walk with them every step of the way. We support them in every way we can. We can make those referral connections. We go to appointments with them. We provide ride shares to get them there. Really, working with families who haven't found that person or organization to walk every step of the way with them. Some of our families are connected to seven or eight different organizations to really create the stability that they need. And we do a 12-month aftercare program. We stay with every family for a year after their children go home to make sure that that stability is intact and they're using those resources that we've connected them to.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about Providence House with CEO and President Natalie Leake. Let me ask about you. I said earlier that you've been in your position since 2001, so that's a long time. How did you
Okay.
come? Yeah, how did you come to work at the Providence House, and why did you pick this for your career?
It's really interesting. So I'm actually a sector switcher. I was in corporate technology, doing e-commerce work and venture capital work and all of that. And I vividly remember being on a flight, a red eye, and thinking, what am I doing? I am not changing anyone's life. And early in my career, actually the founder of Providence House was a high school teacher at the high school that I went to. She started Providence House and used student volunteers. So it's sort of always, I guess, been in my life and in my experience from a very young age, and have interfaced with the organization on and off. When I left tech, I really, was fascinated by the changing landscape of nonprofit where funders and board members were saying, don't tell me a sad story and think I'm going to write you a check. What is your ROI? What is my investment creating in terms of social change and impact? And that was like my language. And really, at Providence House, a lot of our story is told through the data, through the proof of the impact that crisis nursery care can have for families and not only preventing child abuse and keeping kids safe, but keeping families together, that it really is possible through intensive and somewhat short-term intervention, to rebuild the lives of these families and keep their children with them.
Can you tell me a little bit about the history of the house itself? It started in 1981 with Sister Hope Greener. Do I have that right? Can
Yes.
you share a bit of that with us?
So we started on the west side of Cleveland, in a little tiny house. She had five children in the house at a time. She lived in the attic, and we expanded four times on the west side of Cleveland, and have most recently expanded now across the river on the east side of Cleveland. Our waiting lists for admission to the program, we're starting to get to 500, 600 children a year not getting in, even though we were serving between 250 and 300. And we said, it is time to grow. We need to be on the other side of the city so that families don't have 2-hour bus rides to get to us or aren't even connected connecting. And so we have just recently completed a $14 million expansion, which has now we are serving 40 children in total. About 500 children a year can be served in the program. And we still have kids on the waiting list, but we're doing our best to meet the need. And the need is throughout Ohio. In fact, we're in the middle of what we're calling the Every Child Ohio Project. And we are interviewing and meeting with folks in Columbus, folks all across Ohio, saying, would a program like this help your community? If so, what does that look like? Who are the partners that might want to operate a program like this that we could work with? How would it sustain itself? And really starting to take a look at what is happening here in Cleveland and Cuyahoga County as a model for what we may be able to do in other locations around the state and bring relief to those communities and their families, reduce the numbers of kids entering the foster care system, and really focus on healing families and helping families move through these crises without fearing loss of their children.
The expansion you talked about, is that Leo's House? Is that the name of the new one?
So the new one is actually called Hope's House in
Oh.
honor of our founder, Sister Hope. So Leo's House is our West Side site, and then which is actually Sister Hope's father's name. So she named it after her dad. And we opened Hope's House in 2025, summer of 2025.
Okay. And so is Providence House the name of the whole organization, or is there an
Yeah,
actual
Providence House
house?
is the name of the organization, and then we name our buildings.
I see. Okay. I was expecting a house. All right. Got it. So you mentioned that you have experience in business and tech, and I read also you were a teacher at one point in your life. Tell me about how all those skills help you lead an organization like this, because this organization sounds like it's positive and you're happy to run it, but it's also it must be hard, and it must be emotional sometimes.
It is. It's emotional. It's challenging. We are, even as a 45-year-old organization, 80% privately funded. So, there's that challenge of how do we create the community support to continue to not only sustain but grow our services. We are very much, and my whole team would tell you, a mission-driven business, though. We operate under excellent business practices. We are a steward and a fiduciary of the gifts and the investments that come to us to deliver really quality care. We take our licensing and credentialing very seriously, and really strive to elevate the understanding of crisis nurseries nationally. That, these aren't tiny little rocking baby type organizations. These are intensive clinical interventions that are saving families and helping keep kids in those families and healthy and thriving. So, I think for my part, I folks always joke too. I'm not a social worker, never was, and my undergrad degree is actually in fine arts. And then I went on to do marketing and education degrees. But I think all of that helps you think creatively. You have got to be tenacious and creative to do this work. And just
Some
go
of the
on.
way some of the ways you're creative is you hold community events, fundraisers. You're having March Madness watch parties, a fundraiser event with Kendra Scott, a pickleball tournament. Do you feel community support? Does that help you with your budget?
Absolutely. So, as I said, we're 80% privately funded, and about 25 to 30% of that is coming from individuals in the community. We have over almost 5,000 unique donors making multiple gifts a year. This is not the big foundations or corporate sponsors. These are residents in our community who are deeply embracing our mission and want to support our families and kids.
And you also use volunteers as well, right? Is that do they help you with your programming, or are they, I mean, do you have volunteers actually helping with the children? Tell me about your volunteer program.
So we have a really wide variety of our volunteer programs. So we do have childcare volunteers. They are trained and screened just like our staff. There were those extra hands on the floor with the children doing helping us do field trips and reading to the children, helping with their homework if they're in school. But in addition to that, we really want to open our doors to the community to get to know us. So we do done-in-a-day projects. People come and work in the garden or help fold clothing for the donated clothes that come in for the children. Every child here gets a suitcase filled with all 5 sets of new clothes and PJs, and we have volunteers that come in and sort and pack and build those kits. So any way we can engage the community, whether it's for a couple of hours and a done in a day, it's serving on a special event committee or helping us at one of our events, all the way through being directly providing care on the floor alongside our staff.
I would have to think that each case, if you serve 500 families a year, each case is different. But is there an average length of stay? Like, how long is a child with you?
So our average length of stay is about 34 days last year. But it can be a little misleading. We may have a family come in for a week or so because there's a medical emergency and they just need to get that medical care. Otherwise, relatively stable situation. So it could be a very short-term stay. When we get into inpatient psychiatric or addiction treatment, we get into chronic homelessness or a housing issue, we're starting to trip up into that 60 to 90 day window. So it really is driven by more of about the what is the crisis the family is experiencing and how quickly can we reach a safe resolution to get them to the other side.
So it could be something as simple as a medical emergency, and the parents have to, one of the parents or have to be in the hospital, and literally there's no one to take care of the kids. Is that,
Correct.
and they come to
Yeah.
you?
And the majority of our families that we are serving are single female-headed households. So if mom has a medical issue or mom runs into, even a short-term situation where she can't care for her children, there's nobody there.
You mentioned that you just expanded, because my last question was to ask you about future plans, but I guess if you just expanded, you're probably all tapped out now. What are your future plans here?
So I think right now our real focus is, how do we help other places, certainly in Ohio and even elsewhere in the community. We're in a conversation now with Alberta, Canada, wants to expand. They have a more of a children's emergency shelter program. They want to layer in that family work and, really make this, an enduring change for families. How do we, embrace the parents as part of the work so those families remain intact and healthy? So, our vision statement, our vision is children everywhere are in safe, loving homes with their families. And so that's not limited to Cleveland. We certainly would love to see it expand throughout Ohio and even beyond that. Kids deserve and families deserve to be together and be safe.
We've been talking about the Providence House in Cleveland, Ohio's first and one of the nation's longest operating crisis nurseries. And we've been talking with the president and CEO of Providence House, Natalie Leake. Natalie, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up, we are going to talk to a maintenance tech by day who is an artist by night. That is when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
Thank you. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. What used to be referred to as a part-time job or a hobby has taken on the term side hustle for many people. By day, Charles Crabtree is a maintenance technician at Capital University. But within him beats the heart of an artist whose work is now on display on the campus of Capital University. Welcome to All Sides, Charles.
Thanks for having me.
So you're a self-taught artist. What is your chosen medium? What are you making?
Right now I'm using airbrush.
Airbrush? Okay. Airbrush. Tell me more about, for people who don't know what airbrush is. So how tell me how you create a piece of artwork.
Airbrush is a tool that uses air. You plug it in and you use ink or paint. You can use stencils or freehand or templates, whatever you got. Sometimes I use decomposing leaves or whatever I can find, pieces of machines, things I find around work.
How do you use decomposing leaves or pieces of machines? Tell me more.
Sometimes the leaves can give really good textures.
So are you putting them through the airbrush?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, things that I couldn't make on my own. I go out and find natural things here and there.
Okay. And my understanding is you're a self-taught artist.
Yes.
So you didn't like go to school or take a class in this?
No. My mom was an artist, so it kind of runs in the family. I just always loved art. Always did it. Always drawn in school. I had a teacher that told me I doodled too much in class, but always absolutely loved art, really of any kind, music, film, but visual arts, drawing and painting was always what I was pretty good at. So I stuck with that.
Yeah. So this teacher that told you you doodle too much, what did you think of at the time that you're like, I like doodling?
Yeah, it was a math. So math teacher that said that. So I was never big into math. So I kept doodling, kept drawing.
Yeah. Yeah. So whenever you think about your artwork right now, how do you describe it to people? Like what? Because, you know, we're on the radio. What does it look like?
As of right now, I went to a kind of a biomechanics kind of look. It's kind of science fiction-ish.
Yeah, I looked at some pictures of it. So it's very like, I mean, robots, right?
Yes, that, yep.
Yeah, futuristic.
Monsters, yep.
Robots, monsters, futuristic. Why did you choose that? What in your brain said, let's make some monsters?
It's what I love. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love science fiction movies, horror movies. It's just what comes out whenever I start drawing. For a while, I was doing kind of new age paintings, real colorful, but now my work is black and white. I just kind of do what I feel. I go with my intuition, what looks good, what feels good.
So you liked art, you thought about being an artist, but what took you in a different direction? Because, you know, that's, artist is not your day job, it's your hobby, right?
Yep. I'm a bit of a Gemini, I guess. when I was in school, I wanted to go to the military, but then I also loved art. I ended up going to 4 years in the military. And while I was there, I went to Europe and went to Paris and took a trip through the Louvre. And that's when I really decided that's what I want to do with my life. I want to sculpt, I want to paint. And I got out of the military and started doing that.
Okay, so 2 days in Paris. Talk to me about that inspiration. Yeah.
It was incredible. I went to the Louvre. I went to the Arc de Triomphe. I went to Jim Morrison's grave.
As you do.
He was always been a hero of mine also in the arts. But it really did change my life seeing Paris and just how artistic everything is. And they keep all the old buildings. And it's just beautiful there.
Yeah, did you grow up in Columbus?
Yeah, I'm born in Columbus. Yeah, I always have been. Born right at OSU. So,
okay.
Yeah, I'm home.
Well, because you could have gone to the Columbus Museum of Art. What was different about being in Paris and getting inspired by the art instead of here at home?
I mean, I was always inspired by like the Columbus Museum of Art, but just seeing like Michelangelo's sculptures, and those are just incredible, and that a human can make something like that. And that's what always inspired me, was the idea from someone's mind that you can take an idea that wasn't there just moments ago and then work at it and make something and create it and have it there before you is just an incredible thing to me. It truly is like magic.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking to Capital University maintenance technician Charles Crabtree, who is also a self-taught artist. So there's a show of your work right now on display at a gallery at Capital University. Is it called the Schumacher Gallery or Schu?
Correct. It's a Schumacher Gallery at Capital University.
So tell us about, if we go and see your show that's on display, what are people going to see? They're going to see a lot of these robotish, robot-looking monsters. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a write-up called it, Will Biomechanics Create Gods or Monsters?
Yeah.
So what does that mean?
It's something I think about a lot with AI and all this coming on. I think about how some artists are just using AI to just put a few words in and they're creating an image. I'm not sure if that's for me, but if that works for them, that's fine. But I like creating it from my hands. I love the doing. I love.
Yeah. What do you worry about with AI? Because, I mean, the way you depict some of these monsters, they're a little scary, a little intimidating. Do you worry AI is scary?
Yeah, I feel like it's a bit soulless to me, as far as what I can tell. I hate to make a judgment of it because maybe like a filmmaker who doesn't have a lot of money could possibly make a film that way. But for me, it's just not for me. Whenever I see an AI image, it just looks soulless and it looks like there's just nothing there that a human could make.
Well, so tell me about the soul you try to put into your artwork. What does that mean to you?
It's what I feel. It's like comes from the heart. I believe the soul and the heart is connected somehow. And
Where have you had work on display elsewhere besides this gallery at Capital University?
I have about 20 years ago. I was doing it really professionally. I had a show at the Junghaus. That they used to have a gallery on Pearl Street here. But I had kids and I had some illnesses and I've worked through that and I'm kind of returning to the arts now.
Okay, so this is a rebirth for you.
It is, yes.
So 20 years ago you had a show, considered yourself an artist. What does it mean to you to, you know, two decades later be doing this again?
I'm more in love with art this time. Usually I would do 12 to 20 drawings a year, work them out. But last year something happened. I bought a dual action airbrush and I set my mind to master it. And last year I did over 150 paintings just because I really feel I fell in love with art last year, like no other time. And I feel great about it.
Wow. Okay. Well, I mentioned that you're a maintenance technician at Capital University.
Mm-hmm.
So that's your day job. What do you do for your day job? What do you do for Capital?
I take care of the houses for the students, anything they need, you know, that breaks down in the house, I go in and I'll fix it for them and, you know, try to make it better for them.
Okay. So, but I mean, some of your job probably works a little bit with machines. Do you put any of your maintenance work into your artwork?
Here and there. If I find a piece of something broken or something that would look good as a template on my painting, yeah, I'll use it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a son that's going to Capital right now, so that's great too.
Okay. I feel like since you have a display in a gallery at Capital University and you work there, do you feel like your life is creating like some nice circle right now?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Is Capital being very supportive of you?
Yes, they are. Capital is a great university. It's a beautiful university, and I really like everyone I work with, which is really important. Yeah, I enjoy it.
And so they're supporting you as an artist, too. Did you approach them about having a show in the gallery, or did they ask you?
Well, about 20 years ago, I did have a show whenever I was working then, and I started doing all these paintings last year, and people started talking. I was showing it around to my coworkers, and they said, you should have a show, try to have a show at the Schumacher Gallery, and it worked out.
Okay. And is the show still up right now? Can people
it is
see
up.
It?
It's up until April 1st.
Okay.
It's on the fourth floor of the Schumacher Gallery in Capital University in Bexley.
Okay. And do you happen to have a website? Can people buy your artwork, or are you working on that?
You can go on Instagram, I go by The Space Fiend, all one word.
So
you could contact me there.
Okay. Do you put your pieces on Instagram for
yes,
people
I do.
To see?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Can people contact you? Are you selling them?
Yeah, I would. Absolutely. Yeah, I would certainly sell them.
Okay. Well, what do you think your future goals as an artist? Because I know you said you were doing this 20 years ago. You've come full circle. You said you made 150 pieces in 1 year.
Yeah.
Talk to me about the future.
The works I did last year were about 18 by 24. I really feel like I want to do a few big pieces, like 6 foot by 7 foot, some big pieces. I have a friend that does film work. He wants to work with me to do a film.
What would your work be like in a film? Tell me about that.
Well, he pitched the idea to me. I don't want to give too much away, but okay. It's about a painter who creates portals in his painting. So.
All right. No AI, though, right?
No AI, no.
Okay. And if you made 150 pieces this past year, are you still making them every single day?
I am every day, except for one day. I usually take off just the rest. But yeah, every day I usually try to work for about 4 hours at the least.
Okay. Do you have a goal to have more shows after this one closes?
Yeah, I do. Yep. I am showing at the in Logan, the Washboard Music Festival in June. I'll be set up there with prints and paintings, original paintings.
Okay. So like you're going to sell them at the festival?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And can you put your artwork out to like pitch it to people? Like, are you going to take it around and like try to get more shows too?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Okay.
Are there other festivals that you think you might be looking into for where to put your artwork?
There's a comic convention locally here in Columbus called Space. Mm-hmm. I'm looking to display there also. It's a small press and alternative comics.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So what do you want people to know most about you as an artist and your artwork? Whenever they look at one of your pieces, what do you hope they take away from it?
Hopefully get inspired by it. Mm-hmm. At the very least, go and maybe try it themselves. Dry drawing. Maybe, you know, of course, the message.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We've been speaking with Capital University maintenance technician and self-taught artist Charles Crabtree. A showing of his work called Technical Ecstasy is on display at the Schumacher Gallery at Capital University. Thank you so much for joining us for All Sides today, Charles.
Thank you for having me.
And you are listening to Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Four Paws for Ability. The name says it all. Since 1998, the organization based in Xenia has been breeding and training service dogs for children and veterans with disabilities. Four Paws for Ability places about 120 service dogs annually. All of them train specifically for each person's individual needs and disabilities. Jennifer Lutz she joined Four Paws for Ability in 2000 as a volunteer and has been involved ever since. She is now the executive director and she joins us today. Welcome to All Sides, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So you started volunteering back in 2000, so 26 years ago, for Four Paws for Ability. What first drew you into the mission? What drew you to the organization?
Yeah, well, I'd always loved animals, and I had recently moved into the area and was looking for a way to get involved in my local community and being able to make an impact on others while also involving animals really just tied two things that were really important to me. And so I started by volunteering to foster a golden retriever mix for a person with a disability.
Okay, so did you have any experience dog training, or did you kind of learn on the fly?
I would say more of it was learning on the fly. Mm-hmm. We have Four Paws now. In the past 28 years since our founding, we have a very supportive process for our volunteers who are onboarding, a lot of training, a lot of support. At that point in the early years of Four Paws, it was more learning on the fly. Mm-hmm. But I always do say that the first dog I raised, his name was Yanni, and that he changed my life just as much as he changed the young man that eventually received Yanni as a service dog. And it really set the trajectory for my future and with Four Paws.
Yeah. So did you take care of Yanni as a puppy and kind of get things going before other training started, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so I got Yanni as a puppy and was able to raise him. He became part of my home, my life, my family, and working on just regular manners, as well as taking him in public and ensuring that he was confident, obedience, really all those foundational skills that are so important for a service dog.
Yeah. How did you go from volunteer to trainer to now executive director? Tell me about that journey.
Yeah, it's been quite a journey. It's been really exciting, the opportunities that I've had to be involved with Four Paws as the agency has grown and become more established. And so I had the opportunity with Yanni to do some of his advanced training. So I helped him learn how to turn on off lights, open and close doors, pick up dropped items. And the young man that got him, he has cerebral palsy. And so Yanni was his mobility assistance dog and allowed him to be able to live independently. So that whole experience really just opened my eyes to a whole new world and the impact that we could have on individuals who just need some extra assistance through a service dog. And so yes, I started as a trainer and then continued working through the organization and eventually was promoted to associate director and executive director.
How does it feel to be in, like, the executive director, to be in charge of the whole thing? I mean, I can't imagine 20 some years ago that's where you thought you'd end up, but maybe you did you?
You know, Four Paws is a lot smaller than there were not that many staff. Right now, we have a staff of about 65, 70 individuals. We have people here all the time. We have about 500 dogs in our program at any one time. So the Four Paws of today is very different than the Four Paws that I did join. I've been the executive director for 3.5 years now, and I would say it is both an honor and a privilege.
So yeah, you mentioned the organization wasn't always as big as it is now. So what did it look like when you joined versus evolving into 500 some dogs now? Like, how small was it in 98?
Yeah, so the founder, Karen Shirk, she actually started the organization from her apartment. And so there was actually no location. It was just volunteers working in their homes, the founder working in her home. And eventually, so they actually started in the Cincinnati area. And then when the founder moved up to Xenia, which is where we're located, just on the east side of Dayton, we are able to acquire properties, buildings that eventually led us to the campus that we have today.
Okay, so now we can't see it on the radio, but you have a campus. So how big is this? Where are you keeping 500 dogs?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, fortunately, we have a really active volunteer program still, and we're actually very fortunate to have actually over 2,000 volunteers who participate with our program. So we are very, very fortunate in that regard. So a lot of the dogs are actually not on campus. A lot of them are out with the volunteers who are working with them and putting so much loving time and effort into them. So on site, though, we have two main buildings. We have our puppy enrichment program, which is housed in what we call our puppy house. And so that is puppies that are being born and working on those beginning stages up until they're 8 weeks old and able to go with volunteers. And then we have another larger building that has a kennel, veterinary area, training space, as well as our support teams, our volunteer coordinators, individuals who are caring for the dogs on site. So on site, we typically would have maybe 75 dogs or so at a time.
That seems more manageable. Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about the training process for a dog. Who does it? So part of it's done at your facility, but then they go to individual volunteers as well.
Yeah, it starts at our facility and our puppy enrichment program, and it is actually giving the dogs the foundation of exposure to sights, sounds, experiences that are all appropriate to puppies at a young age. We have to start our training at 3 days old. So it's before puppies are born, their eyes aren't open, their ears aren't open yet. And so they are really, really just ready to slowly get exposed to things that they would need to understand and be able to be comfortable with as an adult. And we do it at a very young age, but we start at a very low level. When they go out with the volunteers, they're probably going to be with the volunteers for a year to a year and a half on average. And the volunteers have the dogs with them in their home. They're practicing those different obedience commands, enforcing, supporting proper manners, taking the dogs in public, a lot of different places that they go. And we're always looking for more volunteers to be able to participate in that program. But when the dogs come back for advanced training, they're typically around a year and a half old. And
Mm.
that's when our advanced trainers, we have a training team of about 12 individuals who are actually focused on training the dogs their specific skills. And at Four Paws, all the dogs are custom trained, as you mentioned, as you're joining. So we look at each child. The children are predominantly the placements that we work with, but we do work with a handful of veterans as well. But predominantly it's children. So we look at each child and we say, you know, what are the challenges that they're facing on a regular basis? Maybe they have a seizure disorder, but they also have sensory issues. And how can this service dog be trained to both alert to a seizure, but also support those needs? And that customization is what the trainers do in that last stage of training. Mm-hmm.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we are talking about Four Paws for Ability with Executive Director Jennifer Lutz. So is there, you mentioned earlier that your dog you had was a golden retriever. Are they all golden retrievers? Is there a particular breed, or can it be different breeds?
So at Four Paws for Ability, we use labs, golden retrievers, predominantly mixes of those breeds for individuals that maybe have allergy or sensory needs. We also have golden doodles, which is a golden retriever mixed with a standard poodle. And at times we'll also have papillons, which is a small breed, often for individuals that may have diabetes or a hearing ear dog for someone who may be deaf or hard of hearing. So those are our primary breeds, but technically a service dog could actually be any breed. It's just a task that the dog is providing that make the dog a service dog.
Okay, so you mentioned that you are training the dog for each individual child's specific need. I think a lot of people would know of service dogs as being like seeing eye dogs for people who are blind, but you're not doing that. You're doing other types of services. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. Typically a guide dog or a seeing eye dog, they're trained to be part of a two-unit team where the person with the vision issue is independently using that dog. When Four Paws was founded in 1998, it was because there was a gap within the industry. Individuals weren't having their needs met, and that was primarily actually children. Because children weren't old enough or their disabilities made it challenging for them to handle a dog, they weren't able to access the benefits of a service dog in the same way that an adult could. So Four Paws pioneered a model called our three-unit team, where a parent or a trained adult is actually responsible for handling the dog, but then the dog is providing the service to the child. So a lot of our placements with children end up being local, but because we have such a unique program, we actually have individuals come from all over the United States coming to Ohio because this is where they can get a service dog to help their child.
Okay, wow. So it becomes a family dog, not just for the child, right?
Correct. So for like a seeing eye dog, they need the dog primarily when they go out in public. Mm-hmm. So someone who has vision issues, they know their home. So they don't use the dog in the home. They use a dog out in public. For our types of dogs we're placing, a child can have a seizure, actually in a much more dangerous situation overnight, and have tragic circumstances result from that. And so the need is just as much present in the home as it is out in public. So the dog can go out in public. It still has the same public access rights as long as a parent or an aide at school is handling the dog for the child. The dog can be with the child, recognize the scent of the seizure. The dog actually smells the scent of the seizure before it occurs and can do an alert for the child.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so if it happens in the middle of the night, the dog will alert the adult in the home to come help that.
Exactly. Because even if a dog is sleeping, their nose is still working. So like people, we rely on our eyes to understand what's happening in the world. The dogs do the same thing, but with their nose. So they can be sleeping in bed with the child, know that a seizure is happening, wake up because of the scent change, do a bark alert, which then alerts a parent to be able to come in. And then they can make those steps, pulling covers away, giving medication, calling 911, whatever is appropriate in that situation, the parent will make that determination.
And you said that people come from all over. So you're not just helping Ohioans find dogs. Is that because you mentioned that Four Paws was filling a need? There was a gap in having dogs for children. Does that gap still exist? Is that why people have to come from all around to come to Ohio for this?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So when Four Paws first started, there were very, very few organizations that were willing to work with children. Over time, it has become more common to be able to place service dogs with children. So that part isn't necessarily as unique. However, the types of training that we do, Forepaws has become really well known for the scent training, so dogs using their noses. So we do a search and rescue type dog for a child that might have Down syndrome or autism and experience elopement behavior. And so there are significant safety considerations with that when a child would leave their home and become lost. And so we often hear tragic stories on the news related to that. So having a service dog be able to follow that child's scent and find them quickly and safely can make the difference, life and death, honestly, for that child. But also our seizure training, our diabetic alert training, all those are scent specific training. Mm. So even though maybe you're in California and there's other organizations that would place dogs with children, often the types of training that we do are different, and that's why people are coming to Ohio.
How do people apply to you and tell you what kind of dog they need? And then does it take like a year or two to get the dog trained toward each individual person? How long does it take?
Yeah, because the dogs are custom trained, we don't have like just a set of dogs that people come and pick up.
Yeah.
The dogs are specific to the individual. So the individual does submit an application, which is on our website. And then we have interviews and have supporting documentation that help us create a complete picture of that child and their needs. And that will then help us raise and train a service dog. So the whole process is about a 2-year process.
Okay, 2 years. I also read on your website that your organization has several different programs, you know, ranging from breeding to puppy enrichment. You talked about puppy enrichment earlier, but can you tell me about your prison program? What do you do with prisons?
Yeah, so Forepaws works with different correctional facilities in Ohio as well as Kentucky. And we have dogs, each prison has kind of their own function. So we have North Point, which is in Kentucky outside of Lexington, and there are pre-advanced training prison. So the dogs go from the volunteers into the prison program for a month, living literally in the prison with the inmates in their cells. And the inmates have been trained to help the dogs on some of the foundational pieces for advanced training that we feel like every dog needs to know to be successful in advanced training. But then we have other prisons, and they'll take a litter of puppies. I mentioned our breeding program. At Forepaws, we breed, raise, and train the service dogs. So we have the mom dogs and the dad dogs. And when the moms have their puppies, we can have them here at our facility, or they may go into the prison program, and the inmates will do our puppy enrichment program actually in the prison program.
Is there a fee related to these dogs? I mean, I'm sure you have to make money somehow, but you're a nonprofit, I'm guessing. So, yeah.
We are. So, yeah, Forepaws for Ability is a nonprofit. We are a 501c3. And that means that donations to Forepaws are tax deductible. Forepaws does operate our program, though, on a shared funding model. So individuals that are interested in the service dog, they contribute through their own fundraising, half the cost of the service dog, and the Forepaws matches that with our own fundraising. The actual cost to place one service dog is $40,000. So it is a high amount, but when you consider all the different people, veterinary care, all the different steps involved to get the dog to that point, and that dog will eventually become a life-changing difference to an individual. We see that people find it to be something that they're really happy that they were able to support their child with.
So the families themselves can have fundraisers and say, we're raising money to get, the child
exactly.
A dog. Okay. And then, and then your organization will match the other 20,000. That's
exactly. Yeah. We don't want cost to be a barrier. We know that individuals who have their children have different types of disabilities, there's a lot of expenses they're probably already incurring with therapies and medication, hospital visits, and we want service dogs to be accessible to the people that need them. So even for the families as they're fundraising, we have a support person to even help them with that step so that they don't have to feel alone.
Do you have any goals or initiatives or any expansion plans for Forepaws? I know you talked about how much it's grown over the past 20 to 25 years, but what's the next 5-year plan for Forepaws?
Yeah, at Forepaws, we're always looking at how we can better meet the needs of the families that we're serving. So when we look at barriers, cost can be a barrier. So families, even fundraising, that takes time, as well as the time it takes to get a service dog. So we know that a service dog fills a critical need for that individual. So really all of our initiatives are focused around how do we make service dogs more accessible to the people that need them? What type of sponsorships or grants can we be applying for to help reduce that cost for families, as well as what can we do as an organization to support a timeline that supports the customization, but also supports it in a timely manner.
We have a little less than a minute left. I'm sorry to ask you this with less than a minute, but you've worked there for so long. Do you have a success story you'd like to share? A short one?
Absolutely. So there are so many different success stories. And I think what really, to me, makes a huge amount of difference is when I see the life change that happens afterwards. So individuals that get that service dog, the last service dog that I work with, her name is Planet. And so she was placed with a young woman who is now able to go to college because Planet's there to alert to her seizures at night. And so knowing that that service dog that I worked with and I volunteered with is able to enable her to start a whole life. I mean, it gives me goosebumps just to think about how each dog is not just a number. Each dog is making a true difference in the life of an individual.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time today. We've been talking about service dogs with Jennifer Lutz, Executive Director of Four Paws for Ability. Thank you for your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
This has been Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.